You're listening to the Caracas Chronicles podcast. To read the blog, go to caracaschronicles.blogspot.com. Everybody knows that the Venezuelan economy has been one of the worst performing and slowest growing in the world since the late 1970s. Now a group of academics has come together to try to give us an explanation of that. The book, which will be coming out next year, is called Venezuela, Anatomy of a Collapse. And the project coordinators are Francisco Rodriguez and Ricardo Hausman. Today, we'll be talking to Francisco Rodriguez. He's a well-known Venezuelan academic, used to head Congress's Office of Economic and Financial Advice, and is now a professor at Wesleyan University. Welcome, Francisco.
Very nice of you to have me here. Thank you. Hi to everybody.
Yeah, I'd like to ask you first about this book, where the idea came from and what you're trying to do with it.
Well, to a certain extent, this is part of an old project. When I was working on my dissertation at Harvard University, my dissertation advisor was Jeffrey Sachs, and he had interest in working on the Venezuelan economy. So we wrote a paper that was part of my dissertation that came out in the 1999 Journal of Economic Growth, called Why Do Resource Abundant Economies Grow More Slowly, which was primarily concentrated in understanding Venezuelan economic performance, embedded in a literature that tried to speak about the resource curse. And the resource curse is this paradox, which is that a lot of countries that have a great abundance of natural resources have actually ended up doing pretty poorly in terms of economic growth. And Venezuela is a case of that. Venezuela is one of the slowest growing economies, which has actually had significant negative growth during the last 30 years. So Jeffrey Sachs and I set out to try to explain that. We actually came out with something that we call the overshooting hypothesis, which was very plainly put. Basically what it says is that if a country enjoys a great abundance of natural resources, it's going to be able to sustain living standards in the short run, or in the short and medium term, over relatively sustained periods, which are higher than what it could sustain in the long run. So as it converges towards the long run, the country is going to see a decline in its living standards. And out of that, at that moment, I knew Ricardo Hausman, but we hadn't met and acted professionally very much. But after that, we actually started talking a lot about that explanation. He wrote a paper with an alternative explanation with Roberto Rigobon. And a couple of years ago, we just got together once and said, well, you know, it'd be nice to actually try to make sense out of all of these different explanations that had been posted in the literature. And it would also be very nice to get a group of academics that are specialized in different aspects of the Venezuelan economy. So that, for example, some explanations for the Venezuelan economic collapse could have to do with education, others could have to do with lack of investment, others would have to do with the activity of the state or the lack of activity of the state. So we thought it'd be nice to actually get people who know a lot about each of these things and to get them together to try to make a collaborative work effort to try to understand what happened to the Venezuelan economy. And this is the outgrowth of that. Basically we have about 20 economists and political scientists who are engaged in analyzing different aspects of the collapse in Venezuelan economic growth. And we try to do it not just as a collection of papers, but also as something more collaborative, so that we've had two conferences in which we come out of each of those conferences looking at the interactions between what's being explained in one paper and what's being explained in another one, so that it's really more than a set of papers thrown together. It's actually a coherent sort of intellectual product.
So, Francisco, when can we expect to see this book?
The book should be coming out, hopefully, sometime in the middle of next year. We're currently working on the second drafts of each of the papers. So we had a conference at which those first drafts were presented, and the papers are at the are posted. Those first rounds are posted at the webpage for the Center for International Development at Harvard University. And right now, the authors are working on their second draft with the comments that that were collected at that conference. We expect those second drafts to be ready sometime at the end of the year, and after that, it will just be a question of. Especially in academia, looking for publishers, and,
right?
But hopefully, we can get that resolved by next year.
But it does sound like you work to make it a reflexive process and to have a lot of interaction between the writers, because just reading through the papers,
definitely.
you can see the conversation developing.
Oh yeah, definitely, definitely. We've had and indeed something that we were able to do thanks to the. Support that we got from Harvard University, from the IESA, the Instituto de Estudios Superiores de Administración in Caracas, and from the Corporación Andina de Fomento, was that we actually were able to have two conferences, which is somewhat unusual for these types of projects. And we had the first conference before any of the papers had been written. It was a brainstorming session. And the idea was to actually, before people have already committed to putting in a lot of work in an explanation, actually get them together in a room and get them to think together about the different types of explanations. So even the first drafts were already pretty much well integrated. And then from the first to the second drafts, we had this second conference, which was in April of this year. So with that, the papers have actually shaped out to be pretty much of a collaborative effort.
Right. And what I have in my hand now is what I guess will become the first chapter of the book, Why Did Venezuelan Growth Collapse, which you wrote together with Ricardo Hausmann. Tell me a little bit about where, because both you and Ricardo have been writing about these issues, but from different points of view, so to see you mm-hmm. both writing, co-writing a paper like this, there must have been some haggling there.
Oh well, yeah, but it was a lot of fun actually, and I think that the way that we approach it, and probably has to do with the training that we economists have, is there are different hypotheses here, and both of us might have thought that alternative hypothesis, different hypotheses, might have been behind the explanation, but let's just go and look at the data carefully and see what it says. Some years ago, when I was working on my dissertation, there was a paper with Jeff Sachs that I wrote, where we came up with a certain hypothesis about Venezuelan economic growth. But that was basically that hypothesis said Venezuela had too much oil, so it was living beyond its means as the oil starts running out. Which, in a certain economic sense, it inevitably starts running out because. Right now, we're producing the same amount of oil, but we have three times the population that we had in the 1960s. So, in per capita terms, it's even if it's not physically running out, economically it is. So as that process starts happening, then the country becomes poorer. That was the simpler explanation. Then Ricardo had written a paper where he had said. It actually has to do with volatility. What happened is that Venezuela became more volatile, a lot more uncertainty developed, prices started moving about a bit more. So before you had a stable exchange rate, now you have devaluations all of the times, followed by continuous appreciation. And all of that instability, which is to a certain extent generated by resource, by the excessive dependence on oil, is harmful for the economy. At the same time, there were other people who had been writing. For example, Terry Lynn Carl at Stanford University wrote she's a political scientist. She wrote a book called The Paradox of Plenty, where basically a lot of her explanation was political and had to do with rent-seeking, with the idea that as the economy became dependent on oil, then the economy became much more attuned to having its private sector think about appropriating the rents from oil rather than being productive or investing. So there were all of these different explanations out there, and what Ricardo and I did was to get together and say, well, you know, let's try to look at a way in which we could test these explanations systematically. The first thing that we did was that, we economists work a lot with stylized models, and the idea for these models is that economy is a very complex thing, so you need some type of simplification to try to understand it. But a lot of times the devil is in the details. What it is that you put into those models is what's going to give you a lot of your results. So we actually got together and looked at the different models that we had used, and we actually discovered something interesting, which is that both the explanation that Ricardo and Roberto Rigobon had proposed, and the one that Jeff Sachs and I had proposed, really had one underlying hypothesis in both of them, and both of those models, which we actually hadn't looked at so carefully before. And it was that in both of them, we were assuming as a starting point that Venezuela had no alternative export industry rather than oil. Now, when I say that, of course, anybody who's roughly familiar with the Venezuelan economy will say, but wait, of course, there are other export industries. You know, there's steel, there's aluminum, there's petrochemicals. But to a certain extent, we're good at producing those things because we're good at producing oil. So we have a comparative advantage in oil. So producing those things is not so different from producing oil. But really, we have very little export of textiles, shirts, books, manufacturers, or agriculture. Even we have some restricted exports of cocoa and coffee, which to a certain extent are what's left over from the pre-oil years.
Right.
So what we realized is that what was key in all of these economic models that we had used to explain Venezuela was the fact that in none of those models, other non-oil export industries played an important role. In all of them, they were actually relatively irrelevant.
Right.
And that led us to looking a bit at the comparison between Venezuela and other countries and other economies. And what we found is that what's interesting about Venezuela is that in contrast to, say, Mexico, Indonesia, and Malaysia, and when I named those three economies, I named three economies that were at one time as dependent on oil as the Venezuelan economy was, but that nevertheless now are not so and have grown a lot faster. What's the difference between Venezuela and Indonesia? It's not that Venezuela suffered a different decline in its oil industry than Indonesia did in sort of per capita terms. Indonesian oil rents have been falling just about as rapidly as the Venezuelan ones. It's that in Indonesia, that decline in the relative importance of the oil industry and the relative income that could be derived from the oil industry was compensated by an increase in non-oil exports, and that didn't happen in Venezuela. So that led us to go one step further and say, well, let's look then at what are the determinants of Venezuelan exports, and we have something that's actually very good, which is that the National Institute of Statistics in Venezuela produces a survey of the industrial sector where we have firm level information on how much different industries in the Venezuelan manufacturing sector produce and how much they export. And we started seeing whether, for example, uncertainty or volatility was an important determinant of whether firms exported or not. Whether the firms that learn to export have a greater probability of keeping exporting in the future. The labor legislation has put restrictions that have made it more difficult for firms to export. And we looked at all of these hypotheses. And basically what we come out with
before we get to that part, can I just ask you to clarify what happened before? Because what I found very interesting about the paper is this idea that the absence of a non-oil export sector expands the impact of oil busts on the capital stock. For me, it's not quite clear. I'm not an economist, really, so it's not quite clear to me how that works.
Let me sort of put it at a very basic level. I mean, first of all, imagine an economy in which you have oil and you have manufacturing, and the economy is efficient at both, and it produces and it exports both, and it imports some other things such as food with what it earns from those exports. So suppose that for some reason the price of oil goes down, which is what happened in Venezuela from the 1980s up until the late 90s. the price of oil goes down dramatically. So what would you expect to happen? Well, if the oil price went down, that means that investing in oil is less profitable. So that means that there's a lot of capital and labor that had gone into oil production, which now should not be there and should reallocate itself to other industries. Where is it going to go to? It should be going to the manufacturing industry, which hasn't suffered that shock in oil. So to a certain extent, when you have two industries that are exporters, if you suffer a shock in one of those industries, it's not just that you're a better position to withstand it because you're more diversified, but it's also that you're a better position to withstand it because the second industry acts as sort of a buffer for the first industry. It allows resources to be transferred to the other industry, in this example, manufacturing. And that means that you're going to have a drop in oil, but you're going to have an expansion in manufacturing. Now, imagine that instead you have an economy where there's no manufacturing. You became so specialized in oil that the only thing that you produce is oil, and you buy all of your imports with that. Well, when your oil industry when you suffer an adverse shock in the prices of oil, then what's going to happen is that the resources that you have invested in the oil industry aren't going to have anywhere else to go. I mean, they can go to the domestic industry, they can go into the non-tradables industry, but that's
explain
not going
that,
to increase your level
is.
Of export. I'm sorry?
Can you explain that, what that is? I'm trying to keep this accessible.
Sure, of course. And I'm sorry if I'm getting too technical. What I'm trying to say is that if you so let's pick up the example again. Suppose that your oil industry suffers a negative shock to its prices, so that it becomes less profitable to produce oil. Well, some of the resources that you had invested in oil. If you had a manufacturing industry, it'd be simple. Those resources would just shift and go to a manufacturing industry, and manufacturing would expand. That is, to a certain extent, what occurred in Indonesia and what occurred in Mexico. In Mexico, of course, with the role of the North American Free Trade Agreement. Now, if you don't go, if those resources don't have an alternative export industry, what will happen with them is that you might keep on having them invested in producing oil, but that oil is going to be less profitable because prices went down, or you're going to move them and shift them into the production of goods that are oriented towards the domestic economy, that is, goods that are not exported. Now, to the extent that you do that, your export revenues are going to go down because you're not going to have an alternative export industry that is going to emerge, and therefore the amount of goods that your economy can import, and therefore the amount of machinery or imported intermediate inputs that can sustain your production level are going to go down, and that's going to make your capital stock go down. So essentially what you're going to have is that when the economy is completely specialized in oil, the effect of an adverse shock in oil is going to be much, much greater. Now, just one point to round that out. You might think, say, well, how much sense does it make to talk of an adverse shock of oil to the prices of oil if the price of oil is right now at $70 a barrel? And that's a fair point. Clarification I'd like to make with respect to that is that we're looking at a process that started in the 1970s, and that's what we really want to explain, why the Venezuelan economy declined from the 1970s up until the late 90s. If with the current oil boom the Venezuelan economy starts growing again, that I think would be a somewhat distinct phenomenon. That would also merit explanation. But up until now, the recent boom is just that. It's a boom which we don't know how long lived it's going to be, and up until now it has been relatively short lived. Whereas the decline of the Venezuelan economy is something that lasted for about 30 years.
So now we know that proper alternative export industry didn't develop. And in the paper, you say that there were these five hypotheses going around. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about each and tell us what your paper finds about them.
Yeah. So basically, you can think about five different possible reasons why these. The puzzle is, why was there no Venezuelan alternative export industry as there was in Indonesia? So one reason to start is to say, well, maybe there are no alternative export industries because there never were. And by never, I mean for a very long time in the past, they had disappeared. And once you stop doing something, it's actually a lot more difficult to start doing it. That's a phenomenon that we economists with some somewhat fancy name called hysteresis. But the basic idea is that it sort of also happens to people when they become unemployed. And so if you don't find a new job the first 6 months after you're unemployed, it becomes a lot more difficult to go back into the labor market, because then employers are going to be looking at you like, well, you know, why has this person been out of a job for so long? Mm-hmm. So to a certain extent, something like that can happen to exporters, and that was one of the hypotheses that we wanted to look at. Then there's another hypothesis that has to do with volatility, and it's this hypothesis that Ricardo had developed a lot. Ricardo Hausmann had developed a lot, and it has to do with the possibility that as your economy becomes more dependent on oil, your economy might also become a lot more unstable, because now oil, which is something that's very volatile, oil prices are driving the prices in your economy, and your economy is exposed to a lot more volatility. So therefore, it might not make a lot of sense for you to develop or to invest in developing an alternative export industry, because maybe it's something that's profitable at today's exchange rate, but then the exchange rate is going to become appreciated in the next few years if there's a positive oil boom, and therefore the probability of you're becoming uncompetitive is very high, and we've seen that happen a lot in Venezuela. So that's something that would seem to make a lot of sense. A third hypothesis has to do with the provision of public goods, and particularly of infrastructure, just to illustrate exactly what I mean by that, it's important to think about the following. I mean, we a lot of us who are familiar with what's been happening in Venezuela know that at the beginning of this year, there was a collapse in the main route, the main bridge that linked Venezuela to, that linked Caracas to its main port, to the port of La Guaira. And at that moment, when it collapsed, it created basically a national emergency. The government tried to build an emergency alternate route, which they have built, which is an imperfect substitute, of course, for what was there. And generally, what you see out of that is that, you know, that was a route that it had problems of maintenance, and there were also some geological problems which were highly predictable, but that nobody had really cared, either in this government or previous administrations, had cared about trying to resolve. The high economic costs imposed by that are an example of the cost that a country can face if it doesn't sustain its investment in infrastructure. And something that happened very dramatically in Venezuela is that Venezuela cut back infrastructure investment to one of the lowest levels in Latin America. And the reason it did that was that when Venezuela was hit by the decline in oil prices from mid-80s on, what the Venezuelan state did was that it cut back investment a lot, because it wasn't able to cut back public employment, or it was unable or unwilling to cut back public employment. So that, you know, if you can't make the politically difficult decision of, say, laying off government employees, then you lay off government projects. You stop government projects, and you stop investing in infrastructure or investing in maintenance and led to a collapse in the nation's infrastructure. And infrastructure is something that's very important for exporters. A fourth explanation has to do with labor legislation. So one thing interesting that happened in Venezuela is that Venezuelan labor legislation has actually become one of the strictest labor sets of labor legislation over Latin America. And this is before the current administration, before the Chavez administration. The ratio of the minimum wage to the average wage in Venezuela was about 90%, much, much higher than anywhere in Latin America. There's a lot of work by people at the Inter-American Development Bank, Carmen Paches and James Heckman, documenting this fact. And of course, that means that a lot of Venezuelan formal sector manufacturing firms might have a lot of impediments to trying to compete with other comparable firms from Latin America. And the last hypothesis has to do with a term that Ricardo Hausman and Danny Roderick at Harvard University have called problem of self-discovery. The fact that exporting is something that actually it requires a detailed process of not only of learning how to export, but also just of discovering what it is that you're good at exporting. That it might well be that an economy's export industry, that a certain economy is competitive at doing something, or it's not, and you actually have to try that out. You have to discover it. Korea, for example, one of its first export industries was wigs. You know, who would have thought? I mean, who would have predicted that Korea was going to be competitive in wigs? If they had never tried it out, they probably would have never found out that they were. So this process, what Danny Roderick and Ricardo Hausman have called self-discovery, it basically has to do with the idea that it's that you need a correct set of institutions in order to allow and support the risk taking by potential export firms that's going to allow them to say, well, you know, let's try out to see if we're good at producing wigs or we're good at producing passion fruit, because the only way that we're going to find out is if we actually try that out. Now, if we actually hit it big and you know, Venezuelan parchita, passion fruit, becomes really hot in the rest of the world, then there are going to be a lot of people who are going to want to produce it. It's going to be very simple. But that initial risk-taking process is something that takes public support and takes adequate institutions. So these are, broadly speaking, the five hypotheses that we wanted to test. And we tested them. And how do we test them? We actually looked to see if any of these were important determinants of whether Venezuelan firms exported in reality. And we had this wonderful data set, which is a National Institute of Statistics Industrial Survey, which has firm-level data, and it allows us to see whether Venezuelan how much Venezuelan firms export and when it is that they start exporting, when it is that they stop exporting. And it actually, this is a survey, but it's also a census of large firms. So for large firms, we have very accurate information on them. And we submitted each of these hypotheses to a varied set of statistical tests. And basically what we found, it was not much support, surprisingly, for the volatility hypothesis. It appears that Venezuelan firms are not that sensitive to volatility. We found strong evidence that there were effects of learning by doing, that is, that Venezuelan firms that start exporting are much more likely to keep on exporting. So that one reason why Venezuela might not have a strong export industry is just that it has lacked it for so long. We found very strong evidence that there was a process of self-discovery, as I've termed it, going on, in which when one firm discovers an export sector, other firms are much more likely to jump on the bandwagon, even after you take into account a lot of the relevant economic information, such as prices and costs, so that so that one firm's discovery process really does have an impact on the export behavior. And we also found strong effects of labor legislation. Apparently, Venezuelan labor legislation is making its manufacturing sector remarkably uncompetitive. There's a companion paper, which is a paper with Jose Pineda, which actually looks in a lot more detail at the infrastructure hypothesis, and does find that that can be an important determinant. So to a certain extent, what the data says is that out of these five hypotheses, except for the volatility hypothesis, and perhaps I should emphasize that this is still a first draft of the paper, so part of what we did at the conference was to get suggestions on how we could make even a stronger, more detailed test of the volatility hypothesis. So some of these results must still be taken as preliminary, but right. I think that our first reading of the data, what it says is that most of these hypotheses have some weight, even if there's a question mark around the volatility hypothesis. So the bottom line that emerges out of that is that there is a lot of room for public policies here that would change the incentives to export, and it would allow for the production of alternative export industries. And thus there is space for changing the country's growth experience. Mm-hmm.
But very clearly aimed at establishing alternative exports. Yeah?
Yes. I think that these policies have to be directed at trying to resolve the key problems and the key bottlenecks. So that, for example, when we think about about supporting export sectors, I mean, one of the problems is that a lot of the policies for support of exports that have been carried out in the past in Venezuela and in other countries are just blanket policies for supporting exports. So say to an exporter, we're going to give a bonus of, say, 10% or 20% over how much they export. Now, that's actually not a very focused policy. It's a very expensive policy. It's unlikely to get very far because it's going to cost the state a lot of money. But at the same time, it doesn't really resolve the problem, because what we're saying here is that the real bottleneck in exporting is discovering that you're good at exporting something. So once a country has discovered an export market, the country can so even if it's just one firm that discovered an export market, once that firm starts drawing high profits, there's an example that it gives other firms that market is profitable. And if it's something that other firms in the country can produce, the other firms in the country are going to jump on the bandwagon and are going to start producing that good. So what you really have to focus your policies on is on helping firms capture enter into existing markets, and to help them in the process of discovery and innovation, trying to understand what it is that the country can export, which is something that I think that the Colombians did very successfully in the case of coffee. But it had to do with a focused public policy, which was not a state-centered public policy, but it was rather a public policy that emphasized the collaboration between the public and the private sector in trying to understand what were the bottlenecks that needed to be solved. Hmm.
Do you see any merit at all to the idea that Venezuela simply has too great comparative advantage in oil and in energy, and it should just focus on that because it can't do anything else?
Well, personally, I mean, there's some merit to the idea in the sense that it's a coherent idea, but I don't think that it would go that it really goes very far in positing a potentially advantageous policy strategy for Venezuela. The reason is that a lot of countries have strong comparative advantage in one good, and when you see them totally specialize in that good, they end up not being very prosperous economies. The prosperous economies are the ones that can use that initial comparative advantage as basically a stepping stone to do the types of things that they need to do in order to discover other industries. So when we look at the oil-based economies that were successful, mm-hmm. we see economies that diversify themselves. We see Indonesia, we see Malaysia, we see Mexico. We don't think Nigeria is successful because it devoted itself to producing only oil, although that is what Nigeria has done. We don't think that that makes Algeria particularly successful. So I guess my reaction to that is that if you're doing the right things, you're going to end up producing a lot of things, because an economy doesn't just have a comparative advantage in one good. An economy tends to have potential comparative advantages in many goods. It's a question of actually being able to develop those comparative advantages. For example, to undertake the fixed costs that are necessary to make production of those goods reasonably inexpensive, and for you to be able to compete in international markets. And the strong economies that we see are economies that are highly diversified. So I think that should be an objective, and it's not an objective that we achieve by saying, let's just specialize in oil.
Okay, well, I think this is, I think we've covered a lot of ground in not very much time, and I don't want to take much more of yours, but thank you so much. And are there any last things you would like to add?
Lessons, let's see. I think there are, for me, obviously a set of policy implications that we've been talking about as to how the Venezuelan state should act in order to try to develop a strategy that could resolve and turn around this terrible growth experience that it's had during the past 30 years. I think that there's also sort of a broader lesson, which is that a lot of social scientists have become very focused, and perhaps sometimes extremely focused, during the past decades on very specific phenomena, and that is actually a phenomenon of specialization.
Sure.
So that people become sort of experts in a specific type of financial derivative.
They know more and more about less and less.
Exactly. So I think that one is something that I found really important about this type of work is that we actually forced, without trying to impinge on the fact that people do have a comparative advantage in their specialization, we found that there was a lot to gain from having people across diverse fields talk about a phenomenon. Because, you know, when we're looking at a phenomenon like a country's economic growth, we can't believe that we're going to explain that without looking at political phenomena, without looking at cultural phenomena, without looking at very different types of economic phenomena. So that you need a lot more of a team effort, and to a certain extent, a lot of times the people who work in the natural sciences actually do that because they have teams that are working in laboratories where there are people who are specialized in many different things. So that's what doctors in a hospital will commonly do. And to a certain extent, I think that we social scientists do a lot less of that, and I'm happy that we were able to do some of it, at least in this book.
All right, well, thank you very much for answering my questions, and hopefully over the next few weeks we'll be talking to more and more of the contributors.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot.
That was the Caracas Chronicles podcast. There's much more on the blog at caracaschronicles.blogspot.com.